by Louise Fryer.
Well, there's a French flavour to this prom given by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and associate guest conductor François-Xavier Haute. His repertoire ranges from the 17th century to contemporary works, and this evening's programme covers much of that span, from a suite by Rameau via a selection of Pontelube's Songs of the Auvergne, Anna Caterina Antonacci, the soloist, to the UK premiere of Ligne de Fuite by Martine Matalon, who's Argentinian by birth but a strong Francophile, and to close, Henry Wood's orchestration of Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition. 3 years ago, François-Xavier Haute stood in at short notice for a late-night prom with the London Symphony Orchestra, but tonight he's here on his own terms. I asked him how that felt.
Well, it's something very exceptional to be here because what's the greatest festival in the world. I think what is so special is that we have programs that just don't look like any others.
You're going to be playing as well as conducting the Rameau. Why that piece in particular?
When I first came with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales a few years ago, I found people that just loved to play this music and maybe to share new things that the modern orchestra don't play since years.
François-Xavier Haute, who's going to be conducting not with a baton, but with a drumstick for this first piece, beating time very much in the manner 18th century musicians in Paris would have been familiar with. Well, it was Lully who established the convention of including set piece dances or divertissement in his tragic operas, and Rameau continued the tradition, translating them into something altogether bolder and more dramatic, as we'll hear in this suite from Dardanus, which includes the entry of the warriors, a pair of tambourins, an air grave contrasting with an air en rondo, and a final chaconne. Well, for the premiere of Dardanus, it was Rameau's five-act tragedy about the son of Jupiter, who, according to legend, founded the royal house of Troy. Boxes at the Paris Opera were reserved way in advance, and the aristocracy sent their valets out at 9 o'clock in the morning to guarantee their seats. That idea of a scrum, strangely at odds with the gentility of the music. Well, the leader of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, Leslie Hatfield, has already taken her seat. And just as Rameau liked to stretch convention, so too does our maestro this evening, coming on now with a field drum equally unconventionally positioned beside him on the rostrum. This is François-Xavier Haute.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
No one knew as well as he how to devise an expressive dance, how to summon up each in their turn, a white procession of priestesses, a horde of demons, a tumult of warriors, or the innocent florid games of shepherds, a contemporary describing the French composer Jean-Philippe Rameau. That was the suite from Dardanus, performed here at the Proms by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, with François-Xavier Roth conducting with the aid of the drum you could hear. He likes to use it, he told me, not only because it's traditional, but because he can shake the dances as well as beating time, almost like a drummer in a rock band, he said. And he points out that just as Lully would have conducted by beating a staff, musicians of the day would have been accustomed to hearing the accompanying beat. They would also have been used to hearing the baroque guitar and the oboe played tonight by Einger Hawkson, and the harpsichord was played by Robert Court. And in 2003, François-Xavier Roth founded the orchestra Les Siècles, which performs on modern and original instruments as appropriate, often within the same concert. And there's music from a mix of eras this evening too, as we move now from Paris opera to the Auvergne and the folk songs and dances that inspired the composer Joseph Canteloube. The Auvergne was only incorporated into the French royal domain in the 17th century and has maintained a very strong local identity. Canteloube spent some time in the 1890s collecting melodies and noting down lyrics. It wasn't until after the First World War that his orchestrations of the songs of the Auvergne began to be performed in the concert hall. Canteloube published 5 books of songs in all, the last of them in 1955, and he wasn't interested so much in authenticity as in evoking the atmosphere of the Auvergne, something he achieves according to our soloist tonight, soprano Anna Caterina Antonacci. I asked her about the challenges of singing the songs in the original dialect, a fascinating fusion of Celtic and Latin languages.
Of course, it is difficult because it's really a language that looks sometimes like Spanish or Italian, but just the sound. You cannot recognize the words. But I have to remember that this is a language that is close to Languedoc, so it's really the origin of our culture, of our literature, so it's very fascinating.
And what kind of atmosphere do they conjure up?
Well, it's a timeless atmosphere because shepherd songs can be sung by Greeks or Homer or shepherd or now. So it's something that's timeless and the atmosphere is very calm. It's like a dawn in a green, endless green. So it gives to me this impression of timeless beauty.
And have you been to the Auvergne?
Just in the town. I don't know the countryside, but I imagine that it can be like Wales.
And how do you feel about singing in a concert hall as opposed to taking on a role in an opera?
Of course you have to take more responsibility on you, because when you are just a singer in an opera, the responsibility is shared by the metteur en scène, the chef d'orchestre, and the concert. When you have a program to propose to the public, you are supposed to choose this program, so everything is on you. But also I think that it's very challenging and interesting side of our profession.
Anna Caterina Antonacci. She's going to sing six songs altogether, starting with a pastorale from Book 2. And if you'd like to read the texts, they're available together with complete programme notes on the website. That's at bbc.co.uk/radio3. Just follow the links to the proms. If your idea of shepherds and shepherdesses is a romantic one, then the words of the first song will quickly dispel it. A shepherd calls to a shepherdess on the opposite riverbank, apparently keen to talk business and talk love. When she replies that she has no means to reach him, he responds, "You'd soon have a boat if you were pretty." Charming. Well, the second song is sung by a shepherd whom no girl will love because of his humble profession. Then after a song about a quail, the fourth song portrays a shepherdess betrayed by her lover, who sings, "Here I am, abandoned like the turtle dove that has lost her mate." The fifth song is like a scene from One Man and His Dog, a series of commands to the creature to round up a cow that threatens to wander off. And then it's back to a shepherd and a shepherdess on opposite sides of the river in Bailero. And that applause greets the arrival of our soloist tonight, Anna Caterina Antonacci, and conductor François Xavier Roth, as they take their places with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales for six Songs of the Auvergne by Joseph Contini. Unhappy is he who has a wife, and just as unhappy he who lacks one. Happy the woman who has a good husband, happier still she who is without one. A certain rustic equality amongst the peasants of the Auvergne expressed in Manarose Cronofena, the last of that selection of songs transcribed and then arranged by Joseph Pontenu. Anna Caterina Antonacci, the soloist, with François-Xavier Roth conducting the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. Well, it's the first time François-Xavier has included Pontelude songs in a concert programme, the first time Anna Caterina has sung them, and the first time she's performed here at the Royal Albert Hall at the Proms. She's Italian, but he says she's his favourite French soprano. And they applauded each other at the end of that performance. Coming back together onto the stage now, Anna Caterina, Italian-born, but to be found as often in the opera houses of Paris, Geneva, Athens and San Paolo. A huge cheer for her from the Proms. She's due to sing Carmen at the Grand Théâtre de Luxembourg and Cassandra for Deutsche Oper Berlin, and again performing that role at the Royal Opera House, as well as giving concert performances of Le Mort de Cléopâtre with the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Yannick Nézet-Séguin. Certainly making her mark on the Proms audience here tonight. And she's returning to the platform once more. Amongst the orchestra, Robert Plain was playing the clarinet solo. And Anna Caterina Antonacci applauding the orchestra, and they applauding her in turn. Pontelude once said that folk songs only notated are like pressed flowers, dead and dry. To breathe life into them, they must be played and sung so that the audience can feel the breeze on their skin and almost see the countryside. And the Royal Albert Hall is certainly a wonderful wide open space to sing in. Now, François-Xavier Roth says he's mad about the music of Argentinian composer Martin Matalon, who settled in Paris in 1993 and began a series of collaborations with IRCAM. In 2007, Roth conducted the premiere of Matalon's Ligne de Fuite, and after the interval, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales will be back to give its UK premiere, together with Henry Wood's orchestration of Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition. But first, it's time to hop over the road to the Royal College of Music for more of the Proms Literary Festival with Ian McMillan.
Welcome to this latest sparkling stanza in the Proms Literary Festival, a 20-minute slice of verbal delight on a Thursday evening with me, Ian McMillan, slicer in residence. When I was at secondary school in the 1970s, our regular music teacher, Mrs. Senior, was off one week, and we had a supply teacher called Mr. Sanderson. He got an earring, which marked him out from most of the rest of South Yorkshire's male population in those days. He said, "We're going to try something different today," and we did. He told us he was going to improvise some music on the school piano, and we had to write a poem in response to it. He opened the piano lid and bashed the keys for a couple of minutes. He combed the keys with his comb. He played them with his nose. That's true. There was a stunned silence afterwards until Trevor Butt piped up. Can we do a limerick, sir? And that eternal question of how poetry can respond to music is the subject of tonight's programme. Is the poetry about the music? Is the poetry trying to represent the music? Is the poetry being musical? How can language portray something beyond language? I think that's what Trevor Butt meant. Joining me to get to the bottom of Mr. Sanderson's conundrum, I'm delighted to welcome two of Britain's leading poets. Jo Shapcott has won the National Poetry Competition twice. Her latest collection, Of Mutability, is a wonderful book about the body and illness and recovery and the power of poetry and of music. David Harsent has also won the Forward Prize for his collection, Legion. And when his selected poems came out in 2007, many of us recognised that here was a poet whose work would, in the words of William Faulkner, not only endure but prevail. Both poets are involved with music, having had their work set by composers, and David is known as a librettist, particularly with Harrison Birtwistle. So, ladies and gentlemen, Jo Shapcott and David Harsent. So, David, really, my mate Trevor Butt was right, wasn't it? It is hard to write about music.
Yeah, I think most poems that appear to be about music are really about mood. And there's a sense in which they may as well be about dogs because, you know, music is uninterpretable, I think, in words. What you do get is an impression or a mood that the poet is pressed into writing by. Poetry, of course, you know, is very close to music in the sense that it has notation. And the singing syllables of language kind of matter more in poetry. And there is notation. I mean, there's prosody, there's scansion, beat, and that kind of thing. But music is an abstract form. Poetry is very far from being abstract most of the time anyway.
So, Joe, do you agree with that, the idea that poetry isn't that music is abstract, poetry isn't, so that makes it hard to write about it?
I think that's exactly part of the attraction for poets, because we deal day-to-day with words, which, of course, we love. We revel in language. But I think poets are aware of its frailties, the fact that it's not perfect. And for me, I think that's probably part of the attraction. However, music doesn't have these frail things called words, or not necessarily. And I think that idea of an art form that can exist orally beyond words is incredibly enticing and attractive. And in a way, I think we would all tend there if we could.
Of course, it's more often the case that composers want to set poems. And then what happens, of course, is that that the music of the poem is unpacked, as it were, and to a large extent, of course, traduced.
I'm suspicious when we talk about the aboutness of a poem, if you like. I think if a poem tells its reader that it is about music and about music only, the poem is probably lying.
Well, let's hear a poem of yours. This is one of yours from Of Mutability. I call it Shapcott's Variations, but you could introduce it and maybe give it its full title.
Happily. I got very interested in the way that composers are more kind of out there than poets in the way they talk about their forebears. They're very, very keen to acknowledge influence, so you can have a variation on a theme of, and it can go back and back and back and back. And they're very conscious of lineage often, and say so in titles. Poets too have influences, but we are more private about them. They may reveal themselves to those in the know, but not otherwise. So I thought I'd have a little experiment with that in a poem where the title is practically longer than the poem. Shapcott's variation on Schoenberg's orchestration of Bach's Prelude and Fugue in E-flat major, St. Anne. Where does it come from, this passion for layers? I could eat the lexicon, breathe whole fugues in German and Latin, rub notes on my skin to make the pores sing. I love it like this, when I lose touch with who's the voices, who's the fingers on the bow, the pen, whose mouth the noise belongs to in the end. Numbers make me tremble in spring. I want to counterpoint them until I careen off the edge of the world, disputing with God himself about the number 7.
In that poem, Joe, the music in the poem becomes very much a physical thing, isn't it? Part of your body, the lines, breathe fugues, rub notes on my skin to make the pores sing.
That's right. And I wanted to somehow describe the physical reaction we feel to music, which, again, isn't often spoken about. But it can be, as everyone will know, a very, very physical response indeed. So some of that comes into the poem. And the sheer excitement, not just about music in that poem, but about thoughts, ideas. I think the two experiences, though, are very different, aren't they? In that the reader of a poem gets the chance to look back, look forward, to fall into the poem in a very different way, whereas listening to music is a linear experience and quite a different one.
Well, David, let's hear an extract from one of your poems. It's perhaps not directly about music. This is a poem that's not been published yet. It's going to appear in your new collection called Night, I believe, which has been published in January. So could you introduce tinnitus for us?
Yeah, well, I've got tinnitus, which is irritating condition, especially if it happens to be bipolar and non-stop. I've noticed that composers with whom I've worked tend to not get too close to me in case it might be contagious, because I can't think of anything worse, you know, for a composer than having tinnitus. I once said to George Benjamin when he asked me what it was like, I said, well, sometimes I'm listening to a piece of yours, George's, and I don't know whether it's me or you. This really is not just about having tinnitus. It's about lots of other things too. So each of these little poems in here, each of these sections, has to do with the sort of sound that tinnitus makes, because it's a varied sound. It's not always a ringing in your ears. So one is kind of feet walking through a pebbles, as it were, like on a pebble beach. Another is just a single note on a violin. Another is the noise that swifts make when they're flying around a square somewhere in the south. And this last piece is about rough music. Now, rough music is a form of scapegoating of people turning up outside a house where a couple who are living out of wedlock, or a child has been born out of wedlock, and standing outside and beating with spoons and ladles on kitchen implements just to simply draw attention to scapegoat the person. So, rough music in the lane, the love child lapped in blood and safe at her breast. The pain echoed in wood on wood, steel on steel as they come, the women in their blacks to hound her from house and home, bands of bitches and clacks of crones with their pots and pans, their hooks and ladles and bowls, to beat outside in the street, to stand at her window and howl, while the child takes a taste of green milk, and the dead of night is all she has of her own, and the music goes on and on.
That poem is so good because it's about tinnitus, it's about sound rather than music, but in your description and your reading of it there, it has a kind of musical incantatory quality. And Fiona Sampson's new collection, Rough Music.
Fiona's collection is called Rough Music, and the title poem is actually was a libretto, I think, and it's about Orpheus, so the first poet, Orpheus, whose music, of course, could uproot trees and move rocks. Yeah, I feel close to Orpheus. I just had a piece with Bert Whistler Allborough about Orpheus, much in my mind.
Well, let's talk a bit about words for music rather than words for music, because I know you've both written with musicians. So, Joe, what's the difference, do you think, between writing words for a musician and having existing words set to music?
It's a very different experience. Starting with words being set, the poems that I write, I feel have their own orchestra. That's what I've put into them. So the experience of a composer just coming and taking that poem and setting it is always extraordinary, because it has suddenly a whole new oral world, and sometimes a whole new mood word too. The other way, writing with a composer is entirely different, because you're aware of a lot more technical things of a different nature that you wouldn't take into account in writing a poem. So, for example, the composer may ask you for certain rhythmic effects, certain vowel sounds at certain places, will almost always ask you to write for a particular topic or story. And you're aware too of a kind of paring back on the orchestration that's your own, to let the composer in, and also to let words be heard, because so few of them will be heard when set to music. You have to try and make that as possible as you can for the composer. And you are, you know, however much we like to talk about collaboration, my experience has been that you do become the handmaiden to the composer, inevitably. And if you don't want that, then don't do it. I think that's just part of the job.
I totally agree with that. I mean, Bert Whistle phoned me on occasion and said, I'm doing something for the Nash Ensemble. You know, you've got, and I was writing, at the time I was working on a collection of poems called Marriage. Two sequences. One was about the hair, tends to pop up in my work a lot. And the other was about the relationship between Pierre Bonnard and Marc de Méligny. And it was really about the artist and the artist model. And I said, well, you can either have the Martha Mary division in women or you can have the hair. And he said, well, I'll have the hair. So so I wrote a poem called The Woman and the Hair and delivered it. And pretty soon this became Harrison Burt Whistle's The Woman and the Hair. And there's nothing you can do about that. I mean, it's the way it works. I mean, the composer in an opera, for example, I mean, you know, the composer is da capo in the Cosa Nostra sense. You know, that's in a sense the way it should be. I mean, opera is about music. I mean, it will be the case that the composer will say, well, look, you know, you've got the soprano on stage, she's not doing anything. I need something for her to do. You know, she's got to be singing. Or what happens is that you write the piece, you write the libretto. I mean, you obviously have discussions with the composer and so on. But you write the piece, you then hand it over, you deliver it, and then the weight of his composition, or hers, will start to tell on yours. It's bound to be the case. So there's a very big difference between something that already exists being set and writing for the opera stage, say, for example.
This just brings back to the beginning, this eternal question of how we write poems about music. So, Joe, you brought along an Emily Dickinson poem that tries to get to the heart of what music is. So could you introduce and read it for us?
Emily Dickinson has to be one of my favourite poets, and the reasons why are everywhere to be seen in the poem I'm going to read. It's her use of images. She's almost like a kind of seal, because she lives in more than one element. She can kind of dive down to the deep of her subconscious and come up with some amazing image that almost bypasses the brain of the reader and goes straight to their emotional centres. And in this one, there's more focus, perhaps, on what music might mean, what it means to have that kind of abstraction beyond words. And it tends towards death as well. Musicians wrestle everywhere. All day, among the crowded air, I hear the silver strife. And waking long before the morn, such transport breaks upon the town. I think it that new life. It is not bird, it has no nest, nor band in brass and scarlet dressed, nor tambourine, nor man. It is not hymn from pulpit read. The morning stars the treble led on time's first afternoon. Some say it is the spheres at play. Some say that bright majority of vanished dames and men. Some think it service in the place where we, with late celestial face, please God, shall ascertain.
So, David, that is a poem, an example of a poem that's been set by musicians many times, hasn't it, that one?
I think, something that's close to 30 composers have set this poem, among them Elliot Carter and Judith Weir. Elliot Carter's piece is a five-part madrigal for a cappella choir. Judith Weir's is a concerto. The words don't... So that has to do... she doesn't set the words, so that does have to do with mood and so on. What Emily Dickinson was doing there, or said she was doing anyway, was listening to the ambient music around it. I agree with Joe completely, by the way. It's actually really a poem about death. But listening to the ambient music, which for her was sort of birds of New England and so on, Judith Weir was listening to the ambient sounds, which were for her were was the traffic of the urban noise of Southeast London. So that really does have to do with mood and picking up on mood, mood transference and so on.
It's a great first line, isn't it? Musicians wrestle everywhere, yes. As if, and I think perhaps poets feel this too, as if that music is there to be brought home into a piece, but only through wrestling. It's like a kind of fight to bring to birth a piece.
She's such, I mean, the, you know, we talk about gift in the arts, about, you know, people being gifted or having gift. I mean, the gift of word choice that Emily Dickinson, I mean, it's almost beyond measure to say how big a genius she was. You know, the word choice in this poem, well, it wasn't choice, I mean, it was inevitability. Extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary poem.
Now, David, you've chosen an extract from T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. Could you introduce the piece that you've chosen and just read it for us, please?
Well, I was interested in this because it's thought that Eliot became obsessed by or listened a lot to Beethoven's late string quartet, A minor, string quartet 15. And he wrote to Stephen Spender about this and said, I find it quite inexhaustible to study. There is a kind of heavenly or at least more than human gaiety about some of his later things, which one imagines might come to oneself as the fruit of reconciliation and relief after immense suffering. And the third movement of the String Quartet 15 was written after Beethoven had been incredibly ill and thought he was going to die. So that sort of reconciliation thing is kind of... But Eliot wanted to get, he said, I want to bring some of that into poetry before I die. And Eliot had always been interested, or latterly had been interested, certainly when he was writing the Four Quartets, in getting beyond poetry. And he believed that Beethoven was interested in getting beyond music. I'm going to read a bit from the end of Little Gidding, which I'm sure everyone is a very familiar piece. But it does have to do with reconciliation, and it has to do with deliverance. This is just the very end of Little Gidding. We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. Through the unknown remembered gate, when the last of earth left to discover is that which was the beginning. At the source of the longest river, the voice of the hidden waterfall, and the children in the apple tree, not known because not looked for, but heard, half heard in the stillness between two waves of the sea. Quick now, here, now, always, a condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything. And all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well, when the tongues of flame are enfolded into the crowned knot of fire, and the fire and the rose are one.
There is such a strong sense in the poem that things heard, or more often half heard, are a kind of step towards... I don't know what we might call a huge understanding or a huge step spiritually. And it's expressed orally, which is really, really interesting. It reminds me quite a lot of Keats in the Ode to a Nightingale, in which so much of that poem happens in the dark. So it's the sound world that becomes important to the writer and therefore to the reader. And it's that word half heard, which he uses quite close to the word here in terms of here and now. So it's as if sound means place.
Thank you very much to Joe Shapcott and David Hartsent. And I'd like to finish by showing you a notice I found on a piano in a village hall near Huddersfield that's a poem in itself and tells us something about the relationship between poetry and music. It said, "It's important to move the piano slowly over the grates." That's what's important where words and music are concerned. Move slowly over the grates. Different spelling, of course. Goodbye.
Tonight's Prom Literary Festival was presented by Ian McMillan. The programme was produced by Allegra McElroy. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall here on Radio 3 with me, Louise Fryer, and this BBC Prom given by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and associate guest conductor François-Xavier Rhodes. The orchestra has expanded to completely fill the platform here, ready for two works on an impressive scale. If you're used to Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition in its orchestration by Ravel, you'll hear it with fresh ears in the arrangement by Sir Henry Wood that ends the programme. And before that, the UK premiere of Ligne de Fuite, Lines of Convergence, by the Argentinian-born composer Martin Matelon, who now lives in Paris. The work was commissioned by French National Radio and the Symphony Orchestra of Barcelona and Catalonia, and François-Xavier Rolt conducted the premiere. Well, earlier today I caught up with the composer and asked him about that title, Lines of Convergence.
I was trying to think of three ways of reinterpreting the idea of the line as in space. No? The first one is a line which is a little bit atomized. It's traveling through the whole orchestra, to the sections, to the solos, etc. The second one, all of a sudden, it crystallizes into one, into the four horns, and they do like a line in pointillé. I don't know how you say it. It's a line which is...
Like a dotted line.
Dotted line, thank you. And it's crystallized into one element. And then the last one is more of masses, the line of, as if it's a big brush, you know. That was the idea. And the last one is just resonance, the line as a resonance. So the idea was to reinterpret the idea of the line in three different ways, in a way I can exploit the orchestra in its entirety and especially work with the colors, with the rhythmic aspects, and to contrast a lot between the solo and the whole, and etc. So that was a little bit the idea.
You're certainly working with full orchestral forces, especially the percussion.
Yes.
Is that something that's very important to you?
Yes, in general, I write a lot with percussion because they are extremely colorful. No? There is such a palette of sounds and way of playing and colors, and you have all the sound like metal or sand or wood, etc. So you have a lot of materials and colors, so that's very interesting.
And texture, almost.
Texture, absolutely, yes.
And you're used to working at IRCAM with electronic music too. How is it working with simply orchestral acoustic forces?
Well, many people sometimes tell me, did you have electronic in your orchestral piece? I say, no. And this is, to me, is a very big compliment because it's all the same thing, It's you work with sound, with color. Sound is the most important thing. So whether you do it with electronics or with acoustical, to me, in a way, it's almost the same. So many times, things that I have done in electroacoustics, I reinterpret this orchestrally and vice versa. So it's really two works that feed each other very much.
Composer Martin Matelon. And François-Xavier Rolt returns to the stage now to conduct the BBC National Orchestra of Wales in Ligne de Fuite.
Thank you.
Ligne de Fuite, Convergence Lines by Martine Matelon. François Xavier Roth conducting the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. He conducted the premiere of that piece in 2007. Tonight is its first performance here in the UK. Martine Matelon was telling me earlier how much he enjoys working with François Xavier Roth, but they think along the same lines, converging lines of thought perhaps. Just as Martine's about to open his mouth to suggest something to the orchestra, François Xavier comes out with the very same comment. François Xavier Roth, also passionate about new music. Boulez has been an inspiration for him, and he's due to conduct at Boulez's 85th birthday celebrations being held in France later this month. Those cheers are for the composer, Martine Matelon, making his way onto the stage and receiving a warm embrace from François Xavier Roth, getting a little tangled up on a microphone as he then stretches forward to shake hands with the leader, Leslie Hatfield. All the orchestra applauding, and François Xavier Roth trying to encourage them to their feet. Well, the composer and the conductor are due to work together on an opera, which Matalon describes as a monstrous, perhaps he means preposterous, tale, which he's very excited about. Before that, in fact, tomorrow, Matalon has to finish a piece for the Venice Biennale, which has been performed in a couple of weeks' time by the Orchestra of Padua. Well, Henry Wood, the founder of the Proms, was very keen to include new works. He also introduced many pieces to Proms audiences through the medium of transcriptions and orchestrations, some of which he wrote himself. To end this Prom, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales has unearthed a rarely played version Wood made of Modest Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, which started life as a piano suite. Mussorgsky's piano pieces have inspired many attempts at orchestration, the first by a pupil of Rimsky-Korsakov, Mikhail Tushmalov. That was in 1891. Henry Wood conducted that version in 1916, but the year before conducted his own with the new Queen's Hall Orchestra at the Proms. He gave a dozen or so performances stretching into the 1930s, but then that orchestration gave way to the more familiar one by Ravel. For tonight's conductor, François-Xavier Roth, it's important to put Ravel out of his mind.
I have to find what the composers wanted to do and to say when he composed the piece. And for this example, it is extremely strange, because when he started to do this orchestration, the Ravel's one didn't exist at all. So today for us it's strange, because we know more for sure the Ravel's one. But what we started to do with the orchestra, and I said very specifically to the orchestra, just forget the Ravel orchestration that we have all in mind. We forget it and we try to understand what this great conductor, this great orchestrator, wanted to do.
What are the principal differences that we might notice?
Every single piece is different. Also, he doesn't put all the promenades in the whole cycle, but everything is different. Many things also were took from Ravel. Ravel took some things. I don't know if he knew that, but for example, the beginning of Baba Yaga, it's really something close to Ravel. But I mean, every options are completely different regarding the percussions, regarding the instruments who play, all the themes. So it's nothing to compare.
Tonight's conductor, François-Xavier Roth. And the pictures are The Gnome, The Old Castle, Quarrelling Children at Play in the Tuileries, Cattle, The Ballet of the Unhatched Chicks, Samuel Goldberg and Schmuller, The Marketplace in Limoges, Catacombs with the Dead in the Language of the Dead, The Hut on Hen's Legs, and last but certainly not least, The Great Gate at Kiev. And here to conduct the BBC National Orchestra of Wales in Wood's arrangement of Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, François-Xavier Roth.
Thank you. Thank you.
The artist Victor Hartmann painted the original pictures at an exhibition that inspired Mussorgsky, and transforming the watercolours of Hartmann into fully saturated oils, perhaps. That was Henry Wood's arrangement. François Xavier Roth conducting the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. On stage, a great array of bells, two of the seven percussionists positioned within cage-like structures, a sheet of metal suspended from each side of the framework. They were armed with hammers to create that massive volume of sound, augmented with gongs and also the 32-foot pedal of the great organ here at the Royal Albert Hall to illustrate the gate of Kiev. Well, you could feel it as well as hear it. François Xavier Roth shaking hands with Leslie Hatfield. So Henry Wood actually withdrew his score, but tonight's conductor thinks it's more Russian than Ravel's. He finds himself fascinated by Henry Wood's late Victorian taste for the grandiose, and where better to hear it than in the red velvet and gilt surroundings of the Royal Albert Hall. Nick Whiting, who's the associate leader, was telling me what fun it is to play that arrangement, but also how strange the strings playing where he would normally be counting rests, and then hearing the brass take the line the strings would play in Ravel's orchestration. He says, it's like seeing the same picture, but from someone else's viewpoint. Well, Sunday is Henry Wood Day at the Proms. Two concerts on Sunday. Tonight's prom may be drawing to a close, but at 10 o'clock this evening, the late night prom includes a performance of Pergolesi's Stabat Mater, given by the Early Opera Company, conducted by Christian Kernin. Tom Service will be here in just under an hour on stage to introduce that concert here on Radio 3. But with the cheers ringing around the Royal Albert Hall, along with the bells, I'll say goodbye and hand you over to Jonathan Swain at Broadcasting House.
Louise, thank you very much. Louise Fryer there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to say, there's another chance to hear tonight's prom a week today here on BBC Radio 3 at 2:20 in the afternoon. Also, if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's prom, then just go to the bbc.co.uk/proms and click on share. Well, keeping the founder of the proms very much in the frame.
On Breakfast, each morning through the summer prom season, we'll be bringing you the Sir Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
Well, back to this evening, and in 6 minutes' time, just a little under, In Search of the Gododdin, poet Gwyneth Lewis explores the origins and meanings of the Gododdin, a 6th century Welsh poem elegising the slain British warriors who made a last stand against the Saxons in the famous Battle of Catterick. That'll be at 9:15. Until then, with plenty of French music in tonight's first prom, a little more of it now. Poulenc choral music. This is one of two short settings he made in 1941 for the wedding of a couple of friends. The marriage itself didn't survive, but happily the music lives on. It's Poulenc's Salve Regina. Its sad contours very much in keeping with the words, Hail Queen, Mother of Mercy, to thee do we send our sighs, mourning and weeping in this vale of tears. Strange choice for a wedding, you might think, but this was 1941. The singers are the Rias Chamber Choir, conducted by Marcus Creed. performances of Poulenc's Salve Regina. Don't come much more beautiful than that one. The singers there of the Rias Chamber Choir in Berlin, conducted by Marcus Creed. The performance from a disc of Poulenc's sacred music they recorded for Harmonia Mundi in 1995. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's now 9:15 and time for our feature. The Gododin is an epic 6th century poem, an elegy to the 300 warriors of the old British kingdom who marched from Edinburgh to die in a last stand against the Anglo-Saxons at the Battle of Catterick in Yorkshire. The heroism of those warriors is commemorated in one of the finest poems ever written in the old British language we now know as Welsh. And it's been claimed both as one of Scotland and as one of Wales's oldest literary works. As a Welsh speaker, poet Gwyneth Lewis has known the poem from childhood, and now on a programme first broadcast in January of this year, she goes in search of the Gododin.
Gwyr a aeth gatraeth, oedd fraeth ei llu. Glas fedd ei hancwyn, a gwenwyn fi. Trichant trwy beiriant yn catau, a gwedi elwch, ta welwch fi. Cyd elwynt lanau i benydu. Dadl ddiau, angau i ei treiddi.
Gwyr a aeth gatraeth, men went to Catraeth. 14 centuries ago, a warrior band of 300 men from the old British kingdom of Gododin set out from Edinburgh and marched south to Catraeth, Catterick in Yorkshire, to make their final stand against 10,000 Saxons in a bloody pitched battle. After a week of ferocious fighting, all but three of those 300 warriors lay dead.
Men went to Catraeth. Their host was swift. Fresh mead was their feast, and it was bitter. 300 fighting under command, and after the cry of jubilation, there was silence. Though they went to churches to do penance, the certain meeting with death came to them.
This slaughter was the beginning of the end for the people of the Old North, the true British, against the Saxon invaders. But it left one enduring literary legacy. In the battle's aftermath, one of those three survivors, whose name was Aneirin, fled back to Edinburgh to compose an epic poem in tribute to his fallen comrades.
Gosgordd Gododin, I ar rawn rhin, meirch eiliw eleirch a seirch gwehin, ac ynghynor llu lliwed ddisgyn, yn amwyn called a medd eidin.
The Gododin is one of the very earliest recorded British poems. And I mean British in the widest possible sense. It's written in Brythonic, the language of the Britons, the language we know today as Welsh.
O gysyl mynyddawg, trosasau ysgwydawr, Cwyddasau lafnawr a rannawr gwyn.
It's a series of powerful elegies for the slain heroes of Catraeth.
The war band of Gododin on rough-haired steeds, swan-coloured horses tightly harnessed, and in the van of the host an army attacking, defending the groves and mead of Aidin. Through the council of Mynyddog, shields had been toppled, blades had fallen upon white cheeks. They loved to attack. They bore no shame, the men who did not flee.
Like most Welsh-speaking children of my generation, I was brought up on this poem. We were taught it perhaps to remind us that our language was once spoken as far north as Edinburgh, and as a wonderful example of the Welsh strict metre poetry known as Cynghanedd. What we have here is a poem in Welsh about a group of warriors who gathered in Scotland to fight a battle in Yorkshire. And it's worth speculating that if those 300 warriors had won their battle, perhaps Welsh would still be the predominant language of these islands.
Tydfwch hir, ech ei dir a'i drefydd, ef lladdau saeson seithfed dydd, perheid ei wryd yn wrfydd, a'i gofain gan ei gain gyweithydd. It's about a one person, you know, it's about Tydfwlch Hir. It's a portrait of a man.
For many poets writing in Welsh, the Gododdin is part of their literary DNA. Iwan Llwyd is one of them.
They're all very short poems, but he takes photographs of all these different warriors, you know, and he names them. And some of them are shy, some of them are heavy, some of them are very brave, you know. And he creates these pictures so that something stays after the battle. I mean, there's 1,000 years and more. And I can still see these people, you know.
It's a very, very early piece of poetry. It shows how old our Welsh tradition is. And this was presented to us as a national treasure in a way, you know.
Myrddin ap Dafydd is another poet writing in the Welsh language. Like me, Myrddin first encountered the poem at school.
I remember the emphasis of the teacher on the internal rhymes. This is the birth of the canghanedd, the system we have in Welsh. And gwiraeth, gatraeth, oedd ffraeth, eillu. You can hear the internal rhymes in there. And you can hear also, because of the way the rhymes hit the words, you can hear the march or the gallop even of the horses in the lines, you know. And that had a very dramatic effect on me right from the start.
Because the Gododdin was written in early medieval Welsh, scholars and poets in Wales have always laid claim to it as their poem. However, the story it tells is actually set in southern Scotland and northern England. Mynyddawg Mwynfawr, the leader of the Gododdin tribe, gathers together warriors from the Brythonic kingdoms, Lothian, Strathclyde, Cumbria, North Wales and Elved in Yorkshire, to his stronghold at Dinadin, Edinburgh. We're told that they then spent a year feasting and drinking mead before setting off south on their doomed expedition. If the poem was indeed composed at the time of the battle in the 6th century, then it's probable that its author, Aneirin, was a Scot. And that's why the Gododdin is as much a part of the history of Scottish poetry as it is of Welsh.
A lord of Gododdin will be praised in song, a lordly patron will be lamented. Before Eden, fierce flame, he will not return. He set his picked men in the vanguard. He set a stronghold at the front. In full force he attacked a fierce foe. Since he feasted, he bore great hardship. Of Mynyddawg's warband none escaped, save one, blade brandishing, dreadful. I'm Robert Crawford. I'm a poet and critic who works at St Andrews University, and I included an extract from the Gododdin in the Penguin Book of Scottish Verse, which I co-edited with Mick Imlach. We were very keen in that anthology to show the richness of the early inheritance of poetry in Scotland and to show how many languages had been used in Scotland, or in what we now call Scotland, for poetry. So there's Old Welsh in that book, there's quite a lot of Latin, there's Old Norse, there's Old French, as well as Gaelic and Scots and English. I'm not Welsh, I don't know any Welsh, so I find it quite confusing, probably for those reasons, but more, I think, because it's so fragmentary. And yet there are little details, the drinking of mead, the wearing of gold torques, the riding along on horseback. So it's almost like watching a film that's sometimes speeded up and rushes past you and you don't know quite what's going on, and then it slows down, comes into focus for a moment, and you get this rather beautiful, magnificent, heroic vignette, and then it's off again in a direction that you can't quite understand.
Owain, son of Maro.
Matog.
Cadfanan.
Gwefrvawr, son of Ascaran.
And a naming poem. That's something that's always impressed me about it, the way it names individuals and names some places. So there's a peculiar sense of particularity at the same time as a sense of swirl and flux and not quite knowing sometimes what's going on in the poem.
Cydwel, son of Sona.
Breichiawn.
Llifiau.
Graed, son of Hoygi.
The names are very important. The poet treasures the memories of each individual.
Gwenapwy, son of Gwen.
And with their own names comes the names of the families and everybody connected to that warrior.
Morien, son of Caradog.
Owain, son of Eilad.
So it's a national gallery of remembrance in a way.
Gwgon.
Madog Elved.
Cipno, son of Gwengad.
If Aneirin's National Gallery of Remembrance was first composed in the 6th century, then it would almost certainly have been passed on orally for a few generations, one bard teaching it to another, before finally being written down, perhaps at some point in the 9th century. All the versions we now have of the Gododdin are based on a single manuscript dating from around the year 1275, nearly 700 years after the Battle of Cattraeth. Its 38 pages are a transcript of earlier, now lost, texts of the Gododdin and other poems. It's a Welsh national treasure, kept under lock and key at Cardiff's Central Library.
So we're just opening a door. It does look, in fact, as if we're going into a bank vault, which isn't open. And we're going into through double doors into a concrete bunker with an alarm. Not that I want to give all the security secrets away.
Curator Carol Bowden ushers me into a small room in the bowels of the library so that I can see for myself a great wellspring of the Welsh poetic tradition. The Book of Aneirin.
And, is this the book? Here, this is it.
This is the Book of Aneirin, and these are the old covers, and these are some of the old bindings that have been removed when it was rebound.
Oh, I see. No, this isn't at all how I had imagined it.
My first impression of the Book of Aneirin up close is how small it is. No bigger than a slim volume of contemporary poetry, its original leather covers are placed next to it on the table. Its 38 vellum calfskin pages are stained brown with oils from the fingers of the countless bards and scholars who have leafed through it over the centuries.
There's about 1,400 poetic lines here, and you can see that they have ornamental initials, so you can see where the beginning of the different outlay or verses
so
are.
So, for example, so here there's a red K.
Yes.
At the start of one stanza.
Poring over this beautiful manuscript with me is Professor John Cook of the University of Wales's Centre for Advanced Welsh and Celtic Studies. He's the author of a book examining the Gododdin's text and its context in Dark Age Britain.
There are two scribes. This is the A scribe. He's starting all the stanzas at the beginning of the line with alternating sort of dark green and red ornamental initials. And he seems to be getting about three or four outlay or stanzas to each page here.
What is the difference between the two sections by scribe A and scribe B?
Well, I think by most standards, Scribe A would probably be the better of the two. It's a clearer hand. He also seems to be writing in a more consistent kind of Welsh of the 13th century. So he has more obvious linguistic skills than the B scribe does.
Is he the one using colours?
That's right. He's the one using the coloured initials. And the easy way to tell is that we go over to black initials. So he's using the B scribe, only has the one kind of ink. So as well as being not quite as skillful in some respects as the A scribe, he also seems to not have equipment that is as good as the A scribe. The poor old B scribe is getting the worst of my description so far, but it's for the very reason that he is a little bit more guileless and less well educated and less adept at adapting and editing the Welsh of his own day that his work is more valuable, because it's much more of, when he was copying from the older sources that he had, it was much more a case of what you see is what you get. He could copy letter for letter what he saw in front of him. If it was already in a kind of orthography that he could understand because it was close enough to his own day, he's probably standardizing it to his own standard. But if he's dealing with old Welsh, he can't deal with that. So we just get a very literal, straight copy. So it's almost as though, for the part where he's used old Welsh sources, as though we are looking back at a manuscript 300 years older than the one we've got here. So that makes it very valuable.
Gwyr a aeth gatraeth gan wawr, dy gymyrws ei hoed ei hanianawr. Medd iddynt, melyn, melus, maglawr.
Warriors went to Catraeth with the dawn. Their ardour shortened their lives. They drank mead, yellow, sweet, ensnaring. For a year, many a minstrel was joyful.
The Gododdin is not just the name of a poem. It's also a people, an ancient British tribe whose kingdom straddled what is now the borderlands of England and Scotland. For 150 years or more before the Battle of Cattraeth, the Germanic tribes we now call the Anglo-Saxons had been arriving on British shores and moving northwards and westwards to establish new kingdoms. By the end of the 6th century, the Britons of the Gododdin found themselves neighbours with Deira and Bernicia, two allied English kingdoms whose territory covered modern-day Yorkshire, Northumberland and Durham, and whose intentions were almost certainly to expand that territory northwards. This led Mynyddawg Mwynfawr to rally troops at Dinadin to halt the English tide. The rock on which Edinburgh Castle now sits has been a military stronghold for centuries, possibly even since Roman times. So it's reasonable to assume that this vantage point, with its view over the volcanic plug of Arthur's Seat and the road south into Saxon territory, might have been where Mynyddawg entertained his band of 300 Gododdin warriors. And Mynyddawg seems to have spared no expense in plying them with gifts, golden torques and armour during their year of feasting and drinking mead. As I gaze across modern Edinburgh from the battlements of the castle, my guide to life at Dinadin is Dr. James Fraser, a historian of early medieval Scotland at Edinburgh University.
Now, in the poem, there's much made of the feasting for a year at Caeredin, Edinburgh. In our misreading of this poem in school when I was growing up, we were made to read this as a warning against drinking too much the night before you go into battle. What do you think that's involved? Because that doesn't sound like a very good preparation for warfare to me.
I think my personal reading of that is, you know, to read a year as a really long time, as opposed to getting too worried about the 365 days and no more and no less. The image that the poem itself certainly raises from time to time, which is raised in other poetry from the same epoch, is that the idea of earning your mead. And mead in that context actually stands for the whole contract between these warriors and their chieftain. You know, they get a lot more than mead from the chieftain. They get shelter, they get, you know, all sorts of other things. But mead seems to be the thing that the poets hit upon as the emblematic thing. And the last thing they do before they go out and risk their lives for this guy is they get drunk. This is, you know, reminding these guys just before they head out on the campaign trail who they follow, why they follow him, all the things that he can do for them, so that if they get into battle and things get a bit sticky, they have that little bit of extra backbone given to them by the fact that, well, we really do owe this guy.
So, with their courage and loyalty buoyed up by generous gifts and copious amounts of mead, the warriors would have set off from Dinadin. From where James and I stand on the battlements of Edinburgh Castle, we picture them marching down what's now the Royal Mile towards the old Roman road heading south.
We would be imagining, I guess, men on horseback in some kind of formation, two or three abreast, who knows, carrying their weapons with them, possibly with clingers-on, hangers-on of sort of lowly types or that sort of thing. We can imagine things like banners and horns and music, quite a sort of exuberant farewell, possibly. And probably, you know, people sort of following them down as far as the road, and possibly people lining the roadway as they go along. So, you know, I think if we wanted to imagine a modern-day scenario with soldiers leaving for Iraq or Afghanistan on an airplane or on a boat, and imagine the kinds of emotions that exist, the kinds of people that would be there to wish these people well, you know, that's the kind of thing that's probably happening here. Just the same sort of levels of uncertainty about whether or not people are going to come back. Probably no even remote sense that only three are going to come back, or this is the sorts of carnage that the poem describes.
And of course, the reason why these young men were commemorated and named in the poem was so that they would live forever, and we would help them live forever. And especially when we think now that they're young men dying, you know, nothing's changed really with human nature. Wars carry on, people die in wars, rightly or wrongly. And we would like to remember these young men in a way, remembering our young men today, our sons and brothers and fathers and lovers.
Mary Ann Roberts is one half of Bragod, a musical ensemble in Cardiff who perform medieval Welsh poetry and music based on careful historical research. She and her musical partner, Robert Evans, have created what the very first late 6th century audiences of the Gododdin might have heard as the poem was performed, perhaps even by Aneirin himself. Robert Evans's lyre is based on an 8th century instrument discovered under the floor of a church in Cologne. The lyre is a pleasing combination of straight and flowing lines, and it's far more tractable than I would have imagined.
How likely is it that this instrument would have been in existence in the 6th century, the period of the Gododdin poem itself that we're interested in?
This is the most likely candidate of any instrument to be around to accompany poetry of that period. And in that period, it's very likely that Aneirin, the poet, and other poets of his kind, would have accompanied himself on a lyre.
What about the Gododdin appealed to both of you in terms of the poem itself?
A friend said that it was like watching a 90-minute film in less than 2 minutes. And that's because of the density of the formal wordplay, and it's because of the imagery, and in many ways, my job is to fit the poem to a gridwork of ones and os, like a trellis. And Mary Ann, with her singing, sings over and through the trellis like a growing plant, weaving into the gridwork.
Most of the inspiration of the way I use my voice has come from, one, the instruments, and the way that the instruments work, and two, from the studies that Bob has done. One quote in particular is from Andrew Board, who wrote the first book of knowledge, and in that wrote about the Welsh voice production. He wrote,
My voice and my song and my harp doth agree, much like the huzzing of the humble bee. And Bob actually took me on walks through Butte Park to listen to humble bees. And I really resisted it. I really resisted singing like it because I just thought it would be silly. But when I started singing with this buzzing voice production instead of my normal late 20th, early 21st century voice production, I found that I could almost get inside the sound of the instrument rather than compete with it. This space starts opening up for me to dance in with my voice and with my body as well, with my movement. And as we come together, the voice and the instrument working together, the skies really open up and I can reach to the firmament.
Want tra tri chant e chasav, la ve a me a gaithav, ad wiw am lain lu largav, wod o le o heid merch ang eiav.
On the other side of Cardiff from the church where I meet Bragod, I hear again the Gododdin in its original language, early medieval Welsh.
O chore brein du ar nur caer, Kidney Bay Arthur.
As Professor John Cook reads it, some of the inflections, emphases and pronunciations may sound strange to my ear, but this language is still far closer to modern Welsh than early English is to its modern equivalent.
He tore through 300 most fiercely. He used to kill at both the middle and the far end. He was brilliant in front of the most lavish war band. He used to share out a herd of horses in winter. He used to bring black crows down in front of the wall of a fortified town, although he was not Arthur. Amongst men great in feats, Gorthir was present in front rank of the Alderwood barrier.
I'm interested in the figure of an Aneirin himself. Do we know who an Aneirin was? Does he exist or not exist in the same way as Homer did?
I think the case is a little bit better for an Aneirin than it is for Homer, because he does seem to know and talk about knowing the men that he's elegizing and the celebration that they had for a year. He seems to have been sharing in that luxury himself. So he seems closer in the way that Homer doesn't talk about the way he knew Achilles and Hector. The verse that is prefixed to the Gododdin elegies that talks about how the kingdom of Gododdin is gone, the poetry is no more recited there, and that Aneirin is buried. That would tend to indicate that he was actually based in Gododdin, that he wasn't just an itinerant bard from some other territory who was commissioned to do this, that was his home base, and that his death may in fact have come at the time that Dean Aidan fell. Because they're paired up together, the end of Gododdin and the death of Aneirin in the same way.
There were 300 of them that went into the Battle of Cattraeth, and only three survived. And fortunately, one of those three was a poet, and that's probably the only reason that we know about the Gododdin and about their famous battle.
David Purdy is a poet who lives on the outskirts of Edinburgh, in the heart of what was once the kingdom of the Gododdin. David has known the poem for many years, but had always thought of it as belonging to Wales. But when he discovered its Scottish roots, he decided to reclaim the poem for his homeland by translating the entire work into Scots, the language which gradually succeeded Brythonic in southern Scotland after the fall of the Gododdin kingdom.
I immediately felt that you could almost touch Aneirin's sorrow for his fallen comrades. It was the poem is very moving, and every war, I suppose, has had its poets. And I suppose you could say that An Iron was a forerunner of Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon and people like that who wrote about the First World War. The baldness of the carle, the youth heed of the loon, the smedum of the fecht, the licht shield o'er a boon, the flisk o' lang maned steed, the blae glaive glenton braw, wi' gowd on gairment's bricht.
As the translation emerged, David Purdy began to see similarities between his version and the original Welsh text.
When you read it, there are accounts of battle.